right, Jen Cooper, the keeper, here with the next episode of the Mix Zone Women's Soccer Podcast. Believe it or not, this is episode number 75. I think that makes it a diamond jubilee or a golden jubilee or, no, those are 50 and 60, so who knows? 75, maybe it's platinum. Anyway, 75, Cindy Parlow had 75 international goals. Cindy LaRue so far has 75 caps. And Chrissy Rampone was born in 1975. All right, so two conversations today. First, I sat down with Hal Kaiser, the KeeperNotes.com editor. We talked about the results of the CONCACAF Olympic qualifying draw that was held this week. We also talked about some NWSL player movement. You know, this offseason just never seems to stop. And we talked about one of Hal's areas of expertise that very few in the U.S. can claim, the Korean Women's Pro League, and also the players on the Korean Women's National Team who we might end up seeing in the NWSL. As for the second part of the podcast today, I know that last week I teased that this episode would include a chat with Ella Masser, but we've had to postpone that. Hopefully it will be in next week's episode, so of course, stay tuned. But till then, you can check out the second half of the very first episode of this podcast, recorded back in 2014. The first part was included in the last episode, and I'm sure many of the Mix Zone listeners have not heard it before. The idea for that first podcast was with the announcement of the Houston Dash just a few months earlier. I wanted to help fans, especially Houston women's soccer fans, understand how we got from the 1999 Women's World Cup to having an NWSL franchise in Houston nearly 15 years later. My partner in this conversation is Joe Offenbacher, one of my many co-hosts from the live Keeper Notes soccer show. It's a pretty long chat, which is why the first half was in last week's episode. The second half is in this week's episode. Really hope you enjoy it. All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper, here with Hal Kaiser, Der Kaiser of women's soccer, or Der Kaiser of NWSL. Hal and I are just going to wander around several different women's soccer topics, you know, as we're leading up to the holiday. You know, lots of stuff is still happening. It's a much more exciting offseason than we've had in the last couple off seasons. So first, we're going to talk about the draw for the Olympic qualifying tournament in February. Talk about some player movement, and then we'll talk about one of Hal's many specialties, which is actually Korean women's soccer. So, Hal, tell me about the draw from this morning, the CONCACAF draw.
Well, I think the first thing I found really interesting was that the only seeded team was the U.S. I mean, we knew they were going to be seeded into Group A, and they would play in Dallas because then the semis and the finals are in Houston. But I expected Canada to go automatically into Group B.
As did I.
Yeah, which they did. I mean, they ended up in Group B. They ended up in Group B in slot B1, which is what you would have expected. But they could have ended up in Group A, which would have been quite the group. I mean, as it is, I think if you look at the two groups, Group A looks the more challenging of the two because you have the U.S., but you also have Mexico and Costa Rica, which I would say are two of the four best teams. So one of those is not going through. And then Puerto Rico sort of makes up the numbers in that group. Their first time qualifying to this level, and they're going to have quite a draw to fight through to do anything at all. Yeah,
to me, this is where a lot of the gender discrimination lies. To me, it's in discrimination is not even the right word. It's disrespect that there's so little respect for this process that they don't seed anybody.
Yeah,
you know, that basically they're like, okay, U.S. is A1. Where we've just had the Women's World Cup, you had four CONCACAF teams in the Women's World Cup. You could seed those four teams, you know, or at the very least, seed the best two out of those four CONCACAF teams based on performance, which would be U.S. and Canada. The goal should always be, we want the best possible teams to represent us in the Olympics.
Absolutely.
So you want to do your draw so that the semifinalists are the four potentially best teams. And so I look at Group A, and I feel like Costa Rica and Mexico have both gotten screwed because, you know, they're pretty strong teams. One of them's not going to the semifinal. And on the opposite side of that, Group B being Canada, Trinidad, Guyana, Guatemala, then you're giving one pretty weak team, you know, no offense to any of those teams, but, you know, historically one pretty weak team is going to be getting into the semifinals at the expense of Costa Rica and Mexico. And even, you know, Puerto Rico then ends up in, you know, it's not really the group of death, but they're in a pretty rough group. It's very unbalanced, and there's no need for it to be this unbalanced.
Yeah, I mean, imagine had it been Costa Rica, Canada, and the U.S. all in the same group, that would have been even worse. But it's, I mean, you look at Group B, you're right, it's the weaker group, especially we have to see what happens with Trinidad and Tobago, but they've been such a mess recently. They have players sitting out in protest of the TTFA. Randy Waldrum wasn't in Trinidad for qualifying because he didn't get his ticket to get down there until the night before he was supposed to fly. His name was misspelled. You know, he finally said, look, I need a contract that guarantees my role.
Yeah, it can't be a gentleman's agreement anymore.
you got to define my role, define my responsibilities. We need to have some linkage between the youth system and the senior level team, which doesn't exist today. The whole thing's a total mess, and until you do that, I'm just sitting out. So we don't know whether he'll actually be, at least he doesn't need an airline ticket to get to Houston.
Yeah.
But we don't know whether he'll be on the sidelines for Trinidad. And if he isn't, I mean, if he is, I think if you have the Trinidad team all together, I would argue they're probably the second best team in that group. And you would see them maybe going through to the semifinals. Without them, I mean, Guyana, nobody expected Guyana to get there. They beat Jamaica, which is another
huge upset. This is the first time Guyana had entered Olympic qualifying for CONCACAF, so that's huge.
And Jamaica's
it's
got a lot of
talent. It's huge for Puerto Rico too to get to this level. You know, if we didn't know better, you would think that they had planned it to have Trinidad in Houston, but no, they're clearly not planning any of this.
No,
if they're doing a draw that only seeds.
Yeah, just luck. Just luck of the draw, and it's, you know, it's fortunate that, you know, it would have been nice. We were talking about this earlier. It would have been nice to have Mexico and Houston more of a draw from the standpoint of bringing out fans.
Well, and
Canada's great.
And when you think of Gold Cup, that CONCACAF is always very conscientious about trying to maximize ticket sales, and so the games in Miami are going to have Haiti and stuff like that, and where they put Mexico. I hate that you don't have that same conscientiousness applied to this, where it's like, U.S. will sell their own games.
Yeah, Dallas is going to sell.
Yeah, let's put Mexico and Houston and at least try to get something out of the fact that Ari Romero and Teresa Noyola played for the Dash. Same with Canada being Houston.
Yeah, and you know, it's at least we have the semifinals and the finals in Houston. So they have that, and who knows how they're going to structure the ticket sales to try to benefit from that and selling group stage games.
Assuming Mexico makes the semifinals.
But with Canada, you do get, for the people who are in the Houston area, the people who have been Houston Dash fans, with Aaron McLeod deciding to go pursue Champions League glory in Sweden, it gives people a chance to come out and see her play again and acknowledge her and thank her for her time with the Dash. And then, of course, you have Alicia Chapman. Place for the Dash will be there. Lauren Sesselman, you know, maybe not. Who knows?
And beyond the Dash, of course, you've got Christine Sinclair, you know, and a lot of other great.
You have a lot of great
Canadian
draws for
players.
Canada, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, Buchanan.
Though I have to say, I was disappointed this past summer when you know, we did watch parties for all the Canada games too for the World Cup at the Phoenix, and they were pretty small.
Okay.
Now part of that, I'm sure there's people. It's like they're just engaged to the U.S. And not Canada. There were some people there, but Canada, just as a general population, you're not going to have something to tap into, where here it's like there's a natural engagement with Mexico. Even though it's women's soccer, there's still there's a natural engagement. So I'm just disappointed that CONCACAF didn't take this opportunity where, you know, it's like, hey, let's get your best four, you know, in the semis. Let's, you know, it's like, fine, go ahead and mess with the groups. FIFA did it with the World Cup.
Yeah.
You've done it for the Gold Cup. It's like, we know it's going to be difficult for this tournament to cover its costs, even if the U.S. sells out its games. You know, it's like, just...
they already messed with it, making sure that U.S. played in Dallas.
Yeah.
And then they were going to be playing in Houston in the semis and final, you know, theoretically, we'd assume. But, yeah, no, I totally agree.
But bottom line, so we know the teams, the draw's done. We should hear ticket information soon, you know.
And there's some good storylines. There'll be good games. I look forward to all of them.
Yeah, and I'm excited that there's some new teams in there. It's a great story about Puerto Rico, and we hope to get more information about that. Great story about Guyana, and, of course, the continuing drama with Trinidad and Tobago. And Costa Rica, I'm excited to see just that it's like, have they built on, you know, what they've done over the last year and a half. Well, you know, qualifying for the first time and then bringing in a new coach.
Shirley Cruz. And then you'll get to see a player who hopefully will be playing in NWSL next year, will be a first-round draft pick, you know, early maybe first five or six picks, and Raquel Rodriguez from Penn State, who's a lot of fun to watch. I mean, if you saw the World Cup qualifying last year, she's fantastic. So and of course, by then the draft will have happened. But there's a lot of good players across both groups to come out and see for sure.
And we should be able to see Raquel Rodriguez in some of the NCAA tournament games. So yeah. Penn State is into the Elite Eight, so that's this weekend, and they could make it to the Final Four. So
yeah,
you know, that'll be interesting to watch. So we've also had some player movement. the trades keep coming. The movements keep coming. The surprise for this morning and also leaked last night was that Whitney Engen, who was traded from Western New York for last to Chicago, hopefully she didn't fly to Chicago and unpack any bags. She's headed to Boston in exchange for goalkeeper Alyssa Nair.
Yeah, I feel for Whitney. I like Whitney. When she was in Houston, she's a really nice person to get to know. So I hate to see her moved around like that. But like you said, hopefully she didn't get to Chicago and unpack or anything yet. But it's interesting. Somebody made this point, and I looked back, and it's right. You look at Chicago's press around Whitney Engen coming in was fairly subdued. So you could almost go back and say, oh, okay, yeah, you can see that there was another.
Now we know what to look for next time.
I think it's ultimately a good deal for both teams. I know there's a lot of heartbreak in Boston, a lot of angst around losing Nair. She's the face of the franchise.
And I'll say it for Steph Young right now. Not now, Hal. But go ahead.
Chicago gets a great goalkeeper. That team is looking really good. They have at least one more move that we know to make. That could be another center back. So right now you have Samantha Johnson and Julie Johnston as the two center backs, theoretically, unless another move is made. I mean, it just looks a good team. I think they're pretty well positioned for another playoff run. Boston, I know everybody's flipping out about Boston. I think if you take emotion out of it and look at the collective moves that they've made, I don't necessarily like the value that they've given up to get the players they've gotten, but I think they've done a lot to make that a much better team. And you look at especially the spine with Sinead Fairley, with McCall Zerboni. You put Whitney Engen in there alongside Coleman. That center from the defensive midfielders on back to goal is much, much better than it was last year.
And that's how you build a team, is
that's
from
how you
the
build
spine.
A team. Yeah, the spine. You got to have a strong spine. They've got a good spine. They, with a spine like that, you don't need a goalkeeper who can turn cartwheels in goal. You know, then they announced just a little while ago a move that we heard might be the keeper they'd be bringing in, Libby Stout, who played for Matt Beard at Liverpool. Of course, Whitney Engen did as well.
And that's an important thing to note, is that you're reuniting Engen with a coach that she won a championship with.
Yeah.
He's bringing in another player he knows well. And I have to keep reminding myself that Tom Durkin is no longer with Boston. This is a new Boston that's being built. And as heart-wrenching as it is to lose Nair, it's part of the, it's like, we need to move on and do something. And clearly he got value for Nair.
Yeah, and these are good players that they're bringing in. They also got a second-round pick this year. They got a second-round pick next year. And, you know, they're not going to compete for the playoffs probably this year, this coming year. They'll be better.
But they shouldn't be last.
But you look at where that second-round pick ends up being, and next year, and that's probably as good or better than a first-round pick this year. Maybe not an early first-round pick, but a general first-round pick. So that pick, there's some value in it. They give up a third-round pick this year, which is worth less than the piece of paper here on the floor.
Yeah.
They get a second-round pick this year, which probably isn't worth a whole lot either because it's a shallow draft. But you know, I like the move for both teams, to be honest. I think for once, probably Boston doesn't look hosed on a trade in terms of the value they give up and what they get back. And, yeah, like I said, I think they're going to be a much more difficult team to beat next year than they were this year.
Yeah, we know from having Ari Romero traded last year, that kind of gut kick
yeah.
of, no, it's like, no, she's the heart and soul of our defense. Yeah. Everybody loves this player. You can't trade this player. But
or Megan Klingenberg being the one. I mean, there's people get so, you know, fans get so, they love a particular player. And there were people flipping out that Klingenberg was the one who was going to be left unprotected or ultimately got traded versus Morgan Bryant or Carly Lloyd, when if you take emotion out of it and think logically, there's no other possible decision there. I mean, how could you not?
Someone has to be unprotected.
People saying leave Morgan Bryant unprotected. The number one draft pick from last year, who's a starter for the national team in her early 20s, who's viewed as, you know, the future of the program, you're going to leave her unprotected. I mean, only if you want to replace Boston as the one team that people sort of like to laugh at. I mean, that's, Houston would be reaching that level of
though there's this added level with Alyssa Nair that you know, she is the last remaining original allocation from Boston.
Yeah.
You know, she has been the heart and soul and the, it's not a Cinderella story, I'm not sure what the right word is, but it's like all the hard work she's done, and to finally get that first cap for the U.S. national team last December and to get that third spot on the team, it still kills me. And I know I bring this up a lot, that with the Victory Tour games, it's like we're still seeing Solo get all these caps. I'm like, why isn't it Nair? Why aren't you at least giving Nair or Harris a half? It's like, well, here's the future of goalkeeping.
And there's some impact right now of that failure to experiment with that goalkeeper slot and move people around and whatnot. But and that's, I mean, it's out there right now. We've mentioned on Twitter, but Bianca Henninger is in Mexico training camp this week.
Yeah.
She's looking to switch from the U.S. to Mexico because there's not many prospects for
So
US.
Alyssa Nair, Bianca Henninger, both under 20 Golden Glove winners, pretty sure Nair was, now that I say that. She definitely won the World Cup with the under 20s in 2008.
Yeah.
Now I'm not sure if she got the Golden Glove, but Bianca got the Golden Glove in 2010, playing for Jill Ellis, no less, you know, has never gotten a senior cap. I'm not even sure she's been called into a senior camp.
I don't think so.
You know, and I know we were pretty deep in goalkeepers, but I feel like you've got to at least call them in, give them a camp, and go, yeah, this isn't going to happen, or keep working. So it's like, hey, Bianca's grandparents on one side are from Mexico. She can get that Mexico paperwork. More power to her, you know, and U.S. is lost. It's very similar. It was 2014. It was a U-17 keeper from Texas who went to the U.S. camp. They cut her. She went to the Mexico camp, made the team. In qualifying for the U-17 Women's World Cup, she eliminated the U.S. by stopping a penalty kick.
Well, and that's one of the story of the possible storylines from qualifying here is, I mean, if you look at Bianca's situation, it might be 4 years or more before she'd even get a call up for the United States, the way that they're running the goalkeeper spot.
And at that point, she's 29, 30.
Yeah, and now she could be starting Olympic qualifying. She could be going up against the U.S. come February. You know, who wouldn't want to do that at this point if you're in her shoes?
I mean, not that he's the best example, but at least Klinsmann is occasionally calling in a young keeper.
Yeah.
He's still, to me, too dependent on bringing in Raimondo. But anyway, it's like, we're losing this generation of talent.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's go back to player movements. One announcement from the Dash Friday that they had waived English international Rachel Axon, and that was, for Dash fans, a pretty sad move because she was such a great addition to the team, not only on the field, but personality-wise. And just, I loved her attitude. I loved the way she walked up and took the PK, the first PK that Dash had scored in a long time, that, you know, just coolly, casually converting where it seemed like every other Dash player, if they had to take a PK, it was never going to happen. So she just embraced Houston. She and Ellie Brush were a great, great comedic pair. So why does Dash waive her now?
Yeah, she's sitting in one of those international spots, which unfortunately those are rare and precious, and you expect to get a lot of those spots. And the Dash have made Andressa their standard of what they want to achieve with those spots, and so therefore, you know, they're looking around. They think there's probably better players that they can get into that spot. I think the hard part about it is, She was in her second year of her contract. This was her option year. Back early October, the Dash extended her option. I'll be honest, I'm friendly with Rachel. I don't know that she thought she was actually going to be back. I think she's realistic to know that she might not be back, period. So when they did execute her option, she was excited. And then, 5 to 7 weeks later, she gets released because she's about to go on loan. And I understand that when you're out on loan, you can't be released. You can't be waived. So they had to
waiver. Which would prevent them from signing anybody.
Right, because they're actively looking. I think if you look at this, her particular situation, it points again to the need for a little bit more protection for players, because she's now been planning for the last 5 to 7 weeks around coming back to Houston for next season. Her life is based around that. She gets released. When a player under contract gets waived, they get nothing at all. There's no parachute payment, no termination payment. You're gone. And so now, there's 5 weeks until European teams, the leagues that start in March, there's 5 weeks until European teams report. Those rosters are filling up really quickly, and she has to scramble to find a team to play for at this point. She's 30 years old. She's turned 30. She's homeless, essentially, right now.
And we know she'd love to be in the States.
Yeah, she loves the States. She just spent 2 months in Oregon. She's went off to Hawaii today. It's a business. Everybody knows that. She knows that. But there's got to be a little bit more to protect players from this kind of situation where their contract gets extended and 5 to 7 weeks later they're gone and they're unemployed.
With nothing.
Homeless, yeah. Unemployed, they get nothing.
Because it's one thing to be traded where you can say that's sports.
Yeah.
Because you're still getting paid. You haven't been fired. You've just been moved.
Yeah.
This is like, oh, we re-signed your contract. Oh, psych. No, we didn't.
Yeah. And I mean, if you want to, I personally, even though as much as I love her, I think realistically, if you look at those international spots, I would not have executed her option. I would have said they can probably find somebody better. And if she was not international, I'd keep her on the roster in a heartbeat, but it's just the fact that she's sitting in those international spots. So that is a move that probably should have been made at that point in time, not 5 to 7 weeks later when you've already planned your life around coming back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the question is, why would you execute that option if you really didn't?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think teams need to be held to a higher standard on things like that.
Yeah. Well, and then that's the story, of this league. It's like it started very quickly. It's not like the two previous leagues that had a very slow build up from this is what we want to do and here are the rules. This started very suddenly. The Dash was added very suddenly. I think one of the advantages that Orlando has coming into 2016 is that they've seen what's happened and they actually got to plan coming into it and actually kind of get some things that, like the Dash didn't get for the expansion team.
Yeah.
But it's still a work in progress.
Absolutely.
And we still don't know what the schedule is going to be like for 2016 with the Olympics in August and, if the schedule is going to be pushed further or how many games are going to break. But regardless, it's going to be fascinating to watch. Okay, last topic. Some people may or may not know that Hal has connections in Korea. You posted an article on keepernotes.com recently about one of the Korean national team players.
Yeah, and about the league itself as
yeah.
well. Yeah.
So talk about that.
I think, one of the reasons we talk about this now is the news not so long ago, last week in fact, that Jung Ga-woo, who's a left-sided player for the Korean national team and for Hyundai Steel Red Angels, is going to come to the U.S. next year. So she'll be the first Korean national to play in WSL. I have a long-standing relationship with Korea. I thought it would be interesting after they reached the World Cup second round stage for the first time ever to go over back in October and see what kind of impact that's had on the domestic league and, to dig into the domestic league a little bit further. And I know behind Jun, there's probably another, I know of at least four other players who'd love to come play in the U.S., want to get overseas. I mean, the most well-known Korean player, obviously, is Ji So-yeon,
right.
Who's been playing in England.
For Chelsea.
Right. Park Eun-sun, who's a very large striker, who's actually played center back recently, was playing in Russia at the time of the World Cup. She's gone back to Korea. There's only one other semi-high profile Korean playing outside of Korea, She's playing in Japan right now. But you're about to see, I think, more players going overseas, not just in WSL, but other destinations, because WK League now has been around since the first full season was 2009. So it's got a good long period under its belt. And when you look at the importance of a domestic league, and one of the things that we emphasize in WSL is so key for building the future of the U.S. program, you can look at countries like Korea and a couple of others, Australia is another one, and see the benefit that that domestic league has provided. Because Korea qualified for the World Cup in 2003 only really by virtue of the fact that that World Cup was played in autumn. Had it been played in summer as usual, the way the qualifying was based on, they would not have qualified. But because it was played in autumn 2003, qualifying was based on the Asian Cup in the summer of 2003. And they qualified as a result. They did not qualify again until 2015. Part of that is because that was the last time Australia was not part of the Asian region. Then Australia came in and made it that much more difficult. But you look at the league now existing since 2009 and the investment that's gone into women's soccer, which relative to the U.S., actually the women in WK League get paid better. Every team is owned by a company or sponsored or owned by a company, a corporation, or a government entity, mm-hmm. and they put money into it. And that's just part of the overall Korean system of supporting sports, even lesser-known sports, for the betterment of the country as a whole.
So kind of like instead of having an Olympic committee and all of these federations.
Right. So they get paid well. There's a healthy dose of very good foreigners in the league now. And after, eight seasons now, they're producing some really quality players. And a lot of young players, because it's only really become very acceptable to play soccer in Korea in the last few years. Before that, the player that you mentioned that I interviewed was Cho So-hyun, who's the captain of Korea. When she started playing soccer, everybody said, "What are you? You're a girl. It's not a girlish thing to do. Soccer is too physical. You shouldn't be playing." Nobody was happy that she was playing, but she pressed forward and did it anyway. Stuck with it. Now she's the captain of the national team. She scored in the World Cup against Spain. She just won her third title in a row with Hyundai Steel Red Angels, which is the oldest professional team in Korea. They were founded in 1993, sponsored by the Hyundai Group all the way through. Now they're part of Hyundai Motors Group.
And South Korea had a great game against the U.S. that last warm-up game before the World Cup started.
Held them to a draw.
Yeah, held U.S. scoreless on home soil for the first time in 60 matches. That was a tense one to watch.
And you could see the technical talent there. I think you go forward 4 years, and now you have another 4 years worth of development within the domestic league, which if you can watch domestic league games on YouTube, they're actually pretty competitive. They're probably right up there with FAWSL in terms of quality.
So if you're on YouTube, what should you search for to get these games?
You should probably just tweet me because it's all written in Korean, so I can send you a link. Since I can read Korean, I can find it.
Yeah, tweet
it
Hal_Kaiser, and he'll send you the Korean.
Because unfortunately, it's not shown in English. It's only written in Korean.
But it's there.
It's there. It's under the Korea Football Association, the KFA, account.
So you think we might start to see some Korean players in the NWSL?
Yeah, so Jun is coming. My understanding is it's taking a little bit of time to work out the details because she has a year left under contract with Hyundai Steel, so it'll be a loan.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I know of three other players who've had an interest in coming over, whose highlight videos have made the rounds of the league. There's always, with foreign players, this concern of can they adjust to the pace and the physicality of the game in NWSL. And so I think coaches tend to be more careful, especially with players that they don't know as well, or leagues that they don't know as well, like WK League. I think if Jun comes over and does really well, that probably opens the door to, no pressure on Jun, but but that probably opens the door to other players coming over.
Now, those players, would you say that most of them speak English? None of them speak English?
Almost none of them speak English.
All right, so there's a potential language barrier.
But
they're probably all excited to have the chance to be in the U.S. and learn English.
Absolutely. I mean, they're adventurous. Ji So-hyun has been learning English while she's been in London.
Mm-hmm.
I know Cho So-hyun's been studying English in the hopes that she gets a move overseas. Nothing can replace actually being immersed in it. But it's not uncommon that you have players who don't speak the language. It happens all the time. I mean, football is sort of a universal language.
I just know that sometimes that can be a barrier to, you know, connecting with your teammates.
And, yeah.
You know, I remember with WSA the first season, they brought over a lot of players from, you know, China's national team. And I know those players were thrilled to be in the U.S. and have the opportunity to learn English immersed in it. That, I mean, you know, it's the best way to learn any language is to be immersed in it.
Yeah. And you look at, I mean, born in Houston, so we'll mention the Dash. I mean, the two Brazilians, Camila and Andressa, neither one of them speak English. It helps that they're together so they can...
Right.
And they played together for forever, too. So...
you've got one of the assistant coaches who speaks Spanish, and so you can kind of get by between Spanish and Brazilian Portuguese. But I remember Brittany Bach talking about how, like, Camila would just come up to her with the Google Translate on her phone and just hold it up to her, like, here.
Yes.
This is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It's doable, but I would think it's like it's the more everybody can be part of the team,
the better.
Yeah,
and that's why. I mean, I don't know what all NWSL teams are doing. I do know that a lot of the teams in Europe, when they bring over, like Ji So Young, when she was brought over to Chelsea, part of her package was a tutor, an English language tutor.
Right.
So they actively help with learning the language.
Or with, you know, Naho at Seattle, I remember their, I don't know if it was team admin or the equipment manager or what, but she was Japanese, so that Naho always had a translator.
Yeah, and what would probably happen if we got a Korean in, because... You know, obviously I know the Korean players very well. I'm always on the Dash to get a Korean player and giving them names and things. But if we did, my wife is Korean, so probably my wife gets drafted in to be the Korean player.
Assistant VP of the Houston Dash.
Yeah, the thing with Korean, I don't think people really fully understand this, is Koreans are so incredibly proud that when you have a player of... that goes overseas and can succeed, that's like proud, the whole nation's proud of that. So you would actually, I think, probably see all of a sudden a lot of Korean fans showing up to games.
And there is a large Korean population.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, there is. That'd here, there is in a lot of the cities where NWSL has played.
Now, you spent a month on the road this summer watching Women's World Cup games. Did you guys catch any Korea games?
Yeah, I got two. I saw the opener against Brazil, and I saw the second round game against France.
And how did your wife embrace this game? Because she wasn't the biggest soccer fan before, but now she
is. Yeah, she's been over the years off and on. But yeah, so she did. Let's see, it was the final group stage game against Spain. We watched on TV, and she watched the one against Costa Rica too. The second game when they tied 2-2, which John scored in that game. And that one, she was getting excited. And then when they beat Spain to go through the second round, she's almost jumping up and down, and then she turns to me and she goes, I want to go to that game. So I had two tickets already, and we had our kids with us. I had to go out. We had to go to the stadium and buy tickets on game day so she could go.
I like
and
that. Then, I need to go to that game.
And then
buy me the
she
ticket.
Said, for France 2019, if we go, she wants to go to all the games. So she's she's been won over. So I joked with the Dash organization that if they did get a Korean player ever, they have to... give me a little extra money on the
so
side.
So you can afford France 2019?
Yeah, so I can afford the extra season tickets for my wife to go to Dash games, because she'll want to go. My kids, that means I have to get
take all
two
of them.
Extra
all of the
get
kids
three
have
more
to go.
Season tickets. So there needs to be some kind of deal worked out where I get some kind of compensation for helping.
Instead of a commission, you get
the
extra tickets.
I get
tickets.
The extra three season tickets, yeah.
Nice. Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to see how, you know, the addition of Korean players changes the NWSL. It's uncharted territory, and I think there's a lot of developing countries like that. And by developing, I mean developing in soccer that, you know, NWSL hasn't tapped into, hasn't thought of, especially when, you know, we're not going to pull the German players anymore. We're not
right.
going to pull the French players.
Yeah.
We're not going to pull the English players. We have to start looking elsewhere.
They're all getting more than $37,800.
Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily make sense for them to come.
I can tell you the Korean players, most the high-level Korean players are making more than that $37,800, but I've talked to them, and they'll actually take less money to get outside and have the opportunity to
experience
grow their
the
game,
U.S.
And expand their game. And expand their game, because they see that as, I mean, one of the things Cho said to me when I was interviewing her was, we need to make that next step, and that means getting more international experience. So more players have to start going overseas
and getting broader experience so that we can improve the national team.
Well, and like you talked about that Korean pride, it also I would think it would up the value of the whole team in terms of how fans perceive them, how the media perceives them, and ranking and all that stuff.
I mean, to give you a great example of that or a sense of that, prior to this World Cup, the number of people who knew anything about the Korean women's national team was zip, or who would have watched a game or knew anything about it was zip. However, if you said the name Ji So-yeon, everybody knew who that was.
Because of Chelsea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that gives you some sense of just how big that is.
All right. Well, last thing, give us a soccer phrase in Korean.
Gosh, you put me on the spot. I got a full Korean. Well, I'll tell you.
Can you say dash on Korean, in
the
Korean?
The Korean word for soccer is chugu. So, you know, so if you want to play soccer, if you said to somebody you want to play soccer, they wouldn't know what you were talking about necessarily. You have to say chugu.
Nice. I'm not even going to try to repeat that. All right, Hal, we'll be talking again soon. Thanks.
So NWSL started off with 8 teams. Each team got allocated players from U.S. Soccer, Canada Soccer, from the FMF, and those federations paid the salaries for those players. All right. So one, you've greatly reduced the biggest expense of the team is payroll. Two, the league is being run out of U.S. Soccer in Chicago, so there's no front office. That's, you know, and they can piggyback on all those deals. So that's why the entire league is wearing Nike, because, you know, U.S. Soccer has a deal with Nike. They didn't have really big expectations of themselves in terms of, oh, we're going to have this great website, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. And it's, for those of us that like to follow women's soccer, it's kind of frustrating that there's not more of an engine there to get that information out. But looking at big picture, it's like, yeah, I'm glad there's not this huge department of 10 people that were paying, because the money's not there yet.
Right. You know? And if you follow women's soccer, there are plenty of people that do follow it that you can go to for information. You just may not have the one click, I'm at this major point to where I can get all this. But there's plenty of folks that
cover the women's game. I definitely want to mention the soccerdesk.com, Equalizer Soccer, anything that Dan Laletta writes, allwhitekit.com, great places to find the information. Absolutely. So NWSL started 8 teams, like we mentioned, slightly different cities, scaled down venues for the most part, other than Portland. And as they got comments last year that, okay, the attendance is really small, a lot of people came back, I mean, from the teams and said, it's not just the attendance, it's the cost of the venue relative to the attendance. Sky Blue said, our attendance is a little smaller, but our venue is much cheaper now, so we're actually doing better financially. And bottom line, that's what these teams need to do. They didn't get a lot on TV last year. They had a small deal with Fox Soccer Channel, which of course now is Fox Sports One. But they did require that every team live stream every single game. And to me, that's huge, because you can go back and watch those games later. That's just such a big difference. You can't downplay how much social media has really affected the growth of women's soccer, and these players are so accessible on Twitter and Facebook. You can have these live feeds up on YouTube. There's so many ways to engage with the team and with the players, and you know, I wonder if WSA and social media had just overlapped somehow, you know, because these players were so good at being accessible and just being themselves, as we, you know, experienced yesterday at Dash Day. All the players that we did the Q&A with were just comfortable and natural and funny, and didn't mind making fun of themselves and making fun of each other. And, you know, they,
it's definitely a valid question. It's timing. And there's several different segments, several different iterations of the Women's League. If timing had just been a little bit different, a year this way or that way, we may not.
I need to throw in there that MLS did try to start a WMLS, but U.S. Soccer kind of worked out, said, no, WSA already has this. Don't try to compete with it. And at the time, it totally did not make sense for the women to partner with the men. MLS was only 4 years old, and a couple years would contract to 10 teams. They did not have the resources to pull on a women's league. 15 years later, we're in a completely different situation. So MLS has been rocking and rolling. They just announced, what is Beckham's team number 23, 22? 22. Yeah.
There's a lot of questions about that team in general, but that's a whole other podcast.
But so we're over 20 teams announced. You know, the value of the franchises have increased considerably. So in NWSL, one of the eight teams was owned by the Portland Thorns. So Portland Timbers playing at the same venue, owned by the same organization. So you already have a website, you already have a front office, right, a store, a sales staff, a phone number, an operations staff, a way to get jerseys. And that's got to make a huge difference. Portland's attendance was by far bigger than anybody else in the NWSL. And that comes from already having that infrastructure, where the other groups were starting from scratch or starting from a very skeleton crew that have remained since previous iterations of the league.
And at a different scale level, too. Let's you know, put that in the context, because that's the one thing you always have to remind yourself of on either side, on the Portland side. It's such an event-driven thing, whether it's the men's or the women's game, where it's that doesn't exist everywhere in this country equally,
right,
to where it's like, hey, there's a Thorns game on Saturday,
we're going,
you know,
and they had going. Such a great supporter's name, Rosie the Riveters,
right,
or
Rose City Riveters,
there it is, yeah, you knew what I meant,
yeah.
So Portland won the inaugural season championship, great playoffs. It was Portland, Kansas City in one semifinal. Kansas City was up 2-0, and Portland came back to win 3-2. New York beat Sky Blue 2-0 in their, or maybe it was 1-0 in their semi. So then you had the final at Western New York, mm-hmm, and Portland won 2-0. I was so impressed to see Portland fans travel across the country.
For Kansas City, too.
Yeah.
City semis.
And when the team came back to Portland after winning, there were like 1,000 people at the airport, you know. Right. So that, I think that caught a lot of attention, especially from MLS teams. But I'm sure they're all saying, okay, but it's Portland. It's Portland. There's an asterisk by Portland. They've got a different environment.
Right.
All right. So let's put this in perspective of how Houston got here. For those of you that know me and know what a soccer junkie I am, you probably know that back in 2002 and 2003, I hosted two WSA matches at Rice University. Those were off-season exhibitions, because I was hoping that we could get a team here. And I think the biggest thing I learned from those matches from the soccer business side was leagues don't put teams in cities. Leagues agree to let a city have a team. So I realize what you need. The two things you need is a venue and a local investor.
Right.
All right. So we didn't really have either, you know, but at least I had kind of made a little blip on the radar of, you know, there's interest for women's soccer here. Now, when we got the Dynamo in end of 2005, beginning of 2006, I feel like we really lucked out. I don't think Houston would have ever been seriously considered as an expansion candidate, given that, we did not have a local investor or a venue that was soccer specific. But San Jose, Anschutz only owned it as a favor to the league, wanted to move it and find a new owner. So we got the Dynamo. Eventually they found a 50% partner. AEG remains the last MLS investor that owns more than one team, but they're only at 1.5. So we're looking pretty good. So without the Dynamo coming to town, obviously we wouldn't have the Dash. So jump back to 2013, Portland wins. And then a certain player gets traded to the Dynamo, Servando Carrasco.
And he's just, for some reason, that name, you know, he's got
that name doesn't to, that name doesn't ring a bell, to somebody, but his fiance's name is very familiar with our listeners, I'm sure. So he's engaged to Alex Morgan. She starts spending time in Chris Canetti's box. Chris is the president of the Dynamo, so they start talking. He had already been talking about the league to Mia Hamm, whom he met through the Newtown soccer camps that he did up in Connecticut. Chris is from Connecticut, not far from Newtown, so after the tragedy, he was organizing community events for the kids to kind of just help them heal and give them something special. These were not open to the media. These were just, hey, we're bringing in national team players and MLS players to just play soccer with you. So he met Mia, talked to me about this. He met Alex. She talked up the league. So he starts talking to Merritt Paulson, owner of Portland. And that must have convinced him, because he put a proposal to AEG, you know, the corporate parent of the Dynamo. And they were like, we're intrigued, but give us more proof.
Yeah.
So he leaks it to the media, puts it out on social media, asks fans, what do you think? And then they did a survey with Dynamo season ticket holders and asked for deposits on tickets, and they got more than 1,000 deposits.
In a very short span.
Right. At a very busy time. This is like right around Thanksgiving and MLS Cup, and there's so many other things going on. So Friday, December 12th, they announced the Houston Dash is the 9th NWSL team. And this angered some people in the league because NWSL had said early in the fall there won't be any expansion for 2014. They had already made plans. And
I was going to say August, September, right? I think besides NWSL, even Sunil Gulati came out and said we're not expanding for this next season.
And I, based on what Chris Kennedy said yesterday at the Q&A, I would guess that none of the expansion proposals they had were coming from MLS teams. I do know that there was a proposal from our WPSL team in Houston, the Aces, and I'm sure there were others from, you know, other cities, but maybe the league felt that they weren't ready. But getting this proposal from a team backed by MLS, with all the resources of MLS and a venue like BBVA Compass Stadium, for them it must have been like, okay, we have to do this. We have to take advantage of this. So that was announced December 12th. It was like 8 years to the day, basically, that the Dynamo was announced as coming to San Jose. I just thought that was
odds, right? It was just so perfect.
Yeah, and it was a year to the day of the U.S. Women's National Team playing at BBVA. And I love that they chose, obviously, orange and blue to keep it in the family and Dash to go with Dynamo, but not to be Dynamo. I mean, for copyright purposes, they couldn't use Houston Dynamo. Sure. But I'm glad they didn't anyway, because if they did, then we'd have people saying the Lady Dynamo, and yeah, we don't need that. Yeah. I think Dash is perfect. It was interesting to me, especially as someone who's followed the leagues and knew about the whole Dan Borslow brouhaha, that some people were tweeting, "Oh, it's the new Magic Jack." I'm like, no.
Well, it's much better than Magic Jack for a lot of different reasons.
But I just it makes me happy. It's like, okay, it's the first expansion team in NWSL. We're actually be sitting at nine teams for the first time.
Which brings its own challenge,
its own challenge, because they had already set the framework for the schedule, and they couldn't lengthen the schedule based on contractual obligations with the different federations. So they ended up deciding, okay, we don't want an unbalanced schedule. We want everyone to play everyone three times. So it's going to be a pretty cramped season, but hey, it's all good. It's all good.
We've got a team. We've got a huge opportunity. And that's the way folks in Houston Dash fans should look at this. It's, you know, like Jen said, we're the first expansion team.
Yeah.
We're the first expansion team. Not just the first expansion team, but the first expansion team with an MLS tie-in.
Right.
So the eyes that are going to be on this team are not just from potential investors of, I'm thinking of having an NWSL team,
right,
but also on the MLS side, where folks are probably looking at this and going, okay, well, let's see how an expansion team does, because we know what Merritt was able to do with the Thorns. Let's see how this plays out, and maybe other teams that have their own venue.
Especially because if Houston can make it work, the rest of the MLS teams can't say, oh, well, that's just Houston. It's easy to set Portland aside as an exception, but if we make it work, then, you know, obviously something's going right. And so many of the MLS teams have their own venues that they control that are an appropriate size. Like, obviously, I don't think it makes sense for the New England Revolution to do a women's team playing at Gillette Stadium. You know, but San Jose or maybe LA, I'm not going to hold my breath there, or even opening up to partnerships that Kansas City, you've got Sporting KC and you've got FC Kansas City. They're different ownerships, but maybe there could be a partnership there. You know, maybe Philadelphia could go back to having women's teams. And as these new teams are coming in, Miami, NYCFC, Orlando, potentially Atlanta, you know, rumors about San Antonio, that's another factor. And of course, there's backlash. It's always frustrating to me to read some of the backlash. But to me, it's the people that are the soccer fans that are against the Dynamo adding a women's team, to me, are the same as football fans that troll soccer sites. It's like, if you don't like it, fine, but don't.
There's nothing that says you have to go. If you don't like the women's team,
requirement.
Don't go to it.
Because the concept here that the Dynamo is pushing, and I really like this, is they're just trying to be a bigger club. So think of it. Arsenal has a men's team, a youth academy. They even have a women's team. Sure. It's a club. Barcelona has men's teams, women's teams, handball, field hockey. It's a club. So this isn't about one or the other. This is about building the brand, building the club, developing soccer in Houston. It was interesting to see yesterday at Dash Day, like you mentioned, Joe, that there were people there who were obviously soccer players into soccer who had never been to BBVA before.
Absolutely. While you were hosting the Q&A and we're pretty much confined to your location, I did the normal Joel thing and walk around and listen to people and talk to people and engage. And it was just amazing to me. And again, some of this is coming from the male perspective, obviously, too, right? But to walk around and to listen to conversations, the way you have this whole group of people to include young players, right? Uh-huh. Their parents, their, you know, whatever. And, well, this place is amazing. We've never been here. And it's like, why? Right? It's your pro
why not?
Team. And I mean, yes, I understand that if you're a women's team or a young ladies team, a girls team, whatever, that, you know, following MLS may or may not be your thing. The other thing that you always have to keep in perspective too, though, is a lot of times that game times conflict.
Right.
So that's that perspective as well. So now maybe through this experience with the Dash, some of those teams will make an effort to maybe schedule their things a little bit different to at least partake in the Dash games, and then maybe they'll be able to work. So there's a lot of complex moving parts, but it was amazing to see the eyes light up on some of the young
right.
kids that were like, wow, this is a fantastic place. Look, it's all orange and it's,
for the players too, especially the ones that didn't play at Portland last year that, you know, were like, right. wow, last year our locker room was a little trailer and we played at this little field and there was no practice field. And to walk into this, like, you know, they've got to feel like queens. So,
yeah. And to keep something else in context, too, because a lot is done, especially on the male side, where we constantly have this little thing here in the United States of we have to compare ourselves to Europe. The women's game in Europe is in a very similar spot to what we have here. So let's just keep that in mind when we talk about the Arsenal ladies or the Wolfsburg ladies that won the triple last year and stuff like that. They're playing to crowds that are, you know, not in the 40, 50,000 range
right.
either, and they also face some of the challenges that we have here. So that's just for right. perspective.
Right. And well, and U.S. Soccer made it clear to our player pool, they're like, we want you playing here, even right. though some of them, you know, had contracts in Sweden or France, just,
or Germany,
you know, but they're like,
whatever.
Hey, as we get into the next cycle for Women's World Cup qualifying and Women's World Cup, we need you here. So that's most of the history mm-hmm. up until today. I'm sure there's stuff that I forgot that we can talk about later, but let's segue now into Women's World Cup qualifying and the next Women's World Cup. All right. So Women's World Cup 2015, it'll be hosted by Canada in June 2015. It's going to be amazing. Canada hosted the first ever youth Women's World Cup. That was the U19 Women's World Cup in 2002. And they set a record. They had 55,000 at the final between U.S. and Canada. U.S. won that 1-0 in overtime. Erin McLeod was the keeper with her stunning mohawk. So that's our Houston Dash keeper now. But that was just such a great tournament. All the games had really good crowds. So Canada had been on this for, a fair amount of time ago. So I think it's fitting that the game come back to CONCACAF. I knew it was going to be a while after we got back-to-back Women's World right. Cups in the USA in 99 and 2003 that, you know, that it'd be a while before we got another. So I'm glad that it's as soon as it is. So it'll also be the first Women's World Cup where there will be 24 teams. So the first two Women's World Cup, 91 and 95, had 12. 99 went to 16. So 03, 07, 11 have been 16. This will be 24. So this presents a lot of opportunities and perhaps challenges. I think this is a great thing to grow the game. Unlike the men's side, which is so developed in almost every country, not every country, but almost every country. You know, there's constantly arguments where there needs to be more teams in the Men's World Cup because you have great teams like Sweden not going. You know.
Or how it should be allocated.
Who gets what.
Your federation has one too many because we need to get three in here from our side. And it's like, wait, that still leaves two out. But anyway.
Yeah, now 16, I think, has been a good size for the Women's World Cup, except that, you know, it does kind of leave a couple of good European sides out. Mm-hmm. So making the jump to 24, that means we will probably see some lopsided games in this first iteration of 24, but it's... it means you'll have federations really start to develop their women's teams, knowing that they have a better chance of making the Women's World Cup. So it's a step for the long term growth of the game. It also adds a second round of games. So instead of going straight to the quarterfinals after the first round, you'll have a round of 16, then quarterfinals, semifinals, final. And I'm also excited that since it's hosted in Canada, Canada is not competing Women's World Cup qualifying for CONCACAF. Mm-hmm. And now that it's larger, CONCACAF has 3.5 slots outside of, or is it 2.5 slots? I should have double checked before we started, outside of the host. Right. So in the past, it's always been, okay, U.S. usually gets a slot and Mexico, Canada gets one or the other. You know, last time around, surprisingly, Mexico beat USA for the first time ever. And so USA had to get that half slot and they beat Italy. So we ended up having USA, Mexico, and Canada at the Women's World Cup. But this means we'll have Canada's host. I'm sure USA and Mexico will qualify, likely Costa Rica and potentially another team. So I think that's amazing for CONCACAF, for these teams to have that opportunity and know that there is a chance they can go. So it's worth over the next year and a half to really put a lot into your women's program. We've heard rumors that NWSL is talking to other federations about getting involved with the league, other CONCACAF federations. And, you know, that would make a lot of sense.
It would. You know, who those are? There's a lot of speculation. At this point, we would probably leave that alone until we get something more firm. But it makes great sense. Right, seeing the success.
Yeah, let's do it this, you know, as a cooperative. It makes a lot of sense. So CONCACAF Women's World Cup qualifying will be in October. We just saw this on the FIFA site. It'll be October 16th to 26th in Playa del Carmen and Cancun, which is a horrible place to travel. I actually went to Cancun in 2010. They did it in the same place. They had announced Playa del Carmen and Cancun, and then they just moved them all to Cancun. It's at Atlantes Stadium in downtown Cancun, and the baseball stadium next door. Great venue, easy to get to, easy to get a place to stay, easy flight. You know, the tickets were like $40. It was wonderful. There were like 20 USA fans in the stands. I don't know if they're going to end up moving them all to Cancun, but I would highly recommend if you're looking for a fall trip, and that's a great time to go to Cancun. The rates are low, too.
That was the first thing that stuck out at my mind, besides the location being such a horrible location. It's like, look at the date. That's a horrible date to go to Cancun. It's so expensive.
Well, and they are doing the qualifying tournaments for that qualifying tournament. I think it's May. So they do a pre-tournament for Caribbean and a pre-tournament for Latin America so that they end up filling. I'm sure it'll be an 8-team tournament, two groups of four. You play everybody in your group, go to semis and finals. The semifinal winners qualify. I think third place gets the half berth, something like that. So totally looking forward to that. And then, you know, European Women's World Cup qualifying is underway. Theirs is much longer because they got a lot more countries to play into that. But if you go to FIFA.com and hit Women's World Cup, you can hit on qualifying and see how everyone's doing their qualifiers. Generally, the ones in the other countries you're not going to be able to find, on TV or even online. But I'm thinking with the uptick in demand for the national teams that we'll see these Cancun matches on TV. Unlike 2010, they were not on TV until the U.S. lost to Mexico. Suddenly, the third place match against Costa Rica that they had to win got televised. Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of people wanted to see that. You know? Not that people don't want to see the U.S., period.
Wambach even made a comment. She's like, you don't write about us unless we lose. Like, why is winning so horrible? You know? And there was a great shot of her in that match against Mexico. She got hit in the head and had to come out pretty late in the game, and they're down 2-1, and she wants to get back in. Of course, if you're bleeding, you have to come off the field. Yeah, they went up to her with a staple gun and just stapled the skin back to her head and wipe the blood off. You know, it's like that should have been like on, you know, the top 10 on Sports Center or something like that. That was crazy. All right, so we've got the Women's World Cup qualifying in the fall, Women's World Cup next June in Canada.
An opportunity that is for fans. You don't have to worry about trying to coordinate travel to Europe. Not that there's anything wrong with Europe, or
it's easier.
It's right here.
Yeah,
you know, basically.
Yeah, and all the games will be at a kind of perfect time zone, and I'm really looking forward to that. I'm sure most of those games will be sellout. I guess it'll have more games, so it could easily surpass the 99 tournament in attendance. But even without that, I'm thinking just because the Canadians have really stepped up and embraced the game. It was so neat to see as I was researching our Canadian players how Canada embraced them as bronze medalists, for the Olympics, and just felt that they were robbed of the game in the semifinal. And, you know, it doesn't matter who's right, who's wrong. It's like, it's your team. You support your team. And I love that those players, Aaron McLeod and Christine Sinclair and Dinah Matheson, are heroes in Canada, because that really speaks to the growth of the game worldwide.
All right, time to wrap it up with the back four. First, Olympic updates. As Hal and I discussed earlier, the groups are set for the CONCACAF Olympic qualifying tournament that will be held in Texas in February. The USA group will be based in Frisco, north of Dallas, with Costa Rica, Mexico, and Puerto Rico. And Canada will play its group games in Houston with Trinidad and Tobago, Guatemala, and Guyana. As for the other confederations, here's the status of Olympic qualifying. Oceania's final round between Papua New Guinea and New Zealand was postponed in October, and a new date has not been set yet, but one of those two teams will qualify for Rio. France and Germany are already set for the Olympics by virtue of their Women's World Cup finishes, and the third European team will be determined by a four-team tournament in the Netherlands in early March. The host will compete with Norway, Switzerland, and Sweden for an Olympic berth. England, even though they finished third at the Women's World Cup last summer, they are ineligible to compete as just England in the Olympics, since Great Britain competes as a combined team in the Olympics. I don't know, some of you may remember Team GB, Team Great Britain, in the 2012 Olympics as hosts. They automatically got a team, and that soccer team was mostly English players with a couple of Scots. And in general, I know the various federations within Great Britain did not like the idea of a combined team. So unfortunately, no Olympics for England. The Asian Confederation will also hold its final round of Olympic qualifying in the FIFA window in early March. So Japan, Australia, China, South Korea, North Korea, and Vietnam will compete in a round-robin tournament in Japan, competing for two berths. Note that North Korea is back in action. They were ineligible for the 2015 Women's World Cup. Africa qualifying is complete, so South Africa and Zimbabwe have claimed those two slots. This will be Zimbabwe's first trip to a senior Women's World Championship. Brazil, of course, has an automatic berth as host, and Colombia earned its spot by finishing second to Brazil in the 2014 Copa America Feminina. So 12 teams total for the 2016 Olympics. All right, next, the NWSL draft. NWSL announced last week that the date for the 2016 college draft will be Friday, January 15th. The draft will be held in Baltimore as part of the National Soccer Coaches Association of America annual convention. The draft will consist of four rounds of 10 picks each. And for the latest draft order, check out NWSLsoccer.com, because of course, with trades, that keeps changing. Last year, Hal Kaiser and I provided live audio coverage of the draft, and I appreciate everyone who listened, even though the connection was sometimes awful. But I promise that this year's coverage will be bigger and better. And if you're anywhere near Baltimore, consider dropping in to watch the draft. It will be held in the morning, and there's always some seating available for the public. Next, the Division I Women's NCAA Tournament continues, down to eight teams in the quarterfinals this weekend. It's Florida State, the defending champs, plus Texas A&M, Penn State, West Virginia, Stanford, Duke, Rutgers, and Virginia. Check out keepernotes.com for a list of available audio and video links of the games. For live scores and an interactive bracket, you can go to ncaa.com. And if you're anywhere near Cary, North Carolina, you should consider buying tickets for the College Cup. That's the Final Four, which will be held in Cary on December 4th and December 6th. Those last three games will air live on ESPNU. And last for today, if you haven't already signed the online petition requesting the FIFA Reform Committee to have at least 30% of the FIFA Executive Committee be female, check out that petition at athleteally.org. The letter was originally signed by multiple members of the U.S. Women's National Team, past and present, plus members of the Canadian, Australian, and Swedish national teams, as well as Olympians from several sports. All right, so that's it for this week. As always, please share the news about this podcast with other women soccer fans you know, or just soccer fans you know who might end up really enjoying following this stuff. You can always subscribe via iTunes. If you're not already subscribed, just search for Howler. You can find us at howlermagazine.com, TuneIn, Stitcher, a variety of places, podomatic.com. You know, just spread the word. Thanks, as always, to PK Ray for making this podcast possible, and thanks to everyone in this Thanksgiving week for listening to this podcast.